Hey, I'm Simon Wanji. You guys are listening to The Center Ring.
Okay, so let's start.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Center Ring, aka TCR, aka your favorite esports podcast. Episode 111, coming to you live, pre-recorded from an undisclosed location. The date, June 26, 2018. The time, somewhere around 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. I will be one of your hosts for this journey into esports. Alongside me, as always, I have Anuj. And of course, here is Brett. Hello, Brett.
What's up, man?
Good to have you. I will not lie to you, though. This might be the best episode ever. Not only are we in studio, so we have very nice professional-sounding equipment, if you hadn't noticed, but we also have some very special guests, which I'll get into in just a second. But before that, be sure to follow us on all social media, at The Center Ring on Twitter, our website, tcr.gg, that has the Twitter link, Discord, Twitch, YouTube, Instagram. I think that's everything. Be sure. What's that? Yeah, I think that's everything. iTunes. Any podcast app out there, be sure and follow us, review us, like us, whatever you got to do to make sure we live on into perpetuity. But right now, I do want to introduce our guests. Friend of the show, soon to be father, soon to be husband. He is not only the owner of Team Envious here in Dallas, but also the Dallas Fuel, a very busy man. We have Mike Ruffell joining the show once again. And sitting next to him, a stranger now, but a friend soon to come. We have the brand new, just announced, President and COO of Team Envious and the Dallas Fuel, Jeff Moore. Hello, sir.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for coming. I know we've had Mike on the show in the past and kind of built that working relationship, and Greg, media guy for you guys, sent us an email saying, big announcement, winds are changing with the Envious organization and Counter-Strike scene and just esports in general, getting a Fortnite. I'll ask you more questions here, Jeff. I want to introduce Mike here for a second. As far as where did you feel the need to bring in a president? And can I play the dumb card here? What does the president of an esports organization do?
It's a pretty simple answer. For the past 12 years, you know, my involvement in esports, I've been really focused on our players and our teams and traveling around with my players and our teams and always being there on the front lines with them and really taking good care of them. I think, you know, a lot of people would say we were one of the best organizations over the many years of harboring just good feels and good vibes for the teams as they compete on the big stage. And I was always able to really work with them intently. And I think a lot of that has now changed because of the speed at which esports and the industry is growing, the amount of money that's coming in that we're spending now, the increase in our budgets, and you know, the amount of people that we're hiring in now. We've built this ridiculous staff inside internally for the organization. So I feel like I've been pulled in so many different directions, and I'm getting yanked apart. And so the reasoning behind bringing in a team president and somebody, you know, in that role who can handle the COO role and the team president role like Jeff, with a ton of experience in professional sports and sports marketing, is instrumental in allowing me to kind of continue to do the things that I've always been able to do. And, you know, the business side of things is growing so quickly that we need somebody there to manage that. And Jeff was brought onto the team to manage the business operations of the organization that are growing so quickly. And it's amazing how fast we've built out. Even from 8 months ago, we have so many new people on staff that need some direction, and I can't always be there to give it to them. So hence Jeff joining the team.
So Jeff Moore, brand new president and COO of Envious and Dallas Fuel. Is that one in the same as far as this job title goes? Okay.
That's right.
Very cool. Impressive resume, sir.
Thank you.
What is it? 25 years in sports marketing, 18 years of that being with the Dallas Stars alone.
Yeah.
So not a far office change.
Right. That's right. So I was the first intern with the Dallas International Sports Commission. And it turned into a full-time gig. We moved the Minnesota North Stars down. I got hired as the first employee of the Dallas Stars ever after a really, really late night that featured a stop at Hooters, a stop at the city council. City council first, then Hooters. Then we end up at the Adolphus Hotel until about 4 a.m. And I was getting ready to take a job with World Cup Dallas. And the guy said, no, we need a transition plan. I said, okay. And he goes, and you're the transition plan. You're the first employee. I thought they were messing with me. And so I spent the next 18 years working for the Dallas Stars, the last seven as the executive vice president of sales and marketing, which means I had a whole lot of ticket salespeople come and sell me radio packages to advertise the Stars over the years. And then I left there to go to Austin. I've lived there for about 5-6 years, and I ran the sales and marketing for the Formula One track down there. So we had MotoGP, Formula One, Summer X Games, an amphitheater that had about 14,000 seats. And then recently I moved back to Dallas to join a consulting firm with the sports architect, the group that did the American Airlines Center, AT&T Stadium for the Cowboys, Lone Star Park, U.S. Bank Stadium for the Vikings, the Indianapolis Colts place, and now they're doing the new L.A. Rams Chargers $3.5 billion stadium in Inglewood, which is more like a city than a stadium. Yeah. When you go and see that stadium finished, you will freak out like you'll have never seen anything like that.
Is Jerry going to be a little jealous?
He won't be able to believe it. It's like three times as big as his stadium and nicer. And it's just, it's out of control. It's like it's going to be the craziest thing you've ever seen. And they work on projects around the world. So I was pretty happy traveling around the world, working on sports projects. And then Mike and his group came to me and said, hey, he kind of told me about esports, where they were going, where their team was going. And we talked about the opportunity. It just blew my mind, right?
You were jokingly, when we were walking to the studio, you were joking about your knowledge of esports as far as the big scene and big picture. Why make that change? I mean, is there any type of excitement as far as a new, completely new avenue for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would say I know more about esports than I knew about soccer before I was going to join World Cup Dallas, or hockey before I joined the Stars, or F1 or MotoGP before I joined the Stars.
Are you native Texan?
I'm from a suburb. I'm from Oklahoma City.
Okay. So South hockey,
yeah, so
not.
I'm from the part of the suburb that Texans make fun of. You know, that is held only through a vortex of sucking that holds the state of Texas in. But so I wouldn't say, I mean, you know, my core sports growing up are baseball, basketball, football. And ironically, I've only ever worked, you know, for the Rangers here. But to me, it's not necessarily about the sport. It's about all the things that make that sport great. And it's connecting with the fans. It's taking care of the fans. It's serving the fans. So my goal is to, you know, if you serve your employees and you have happy employees make for happy fans, right? Like, you take care of your group, they'll take care of the fans. I can't take care of, you know, there's 300,000 Overwatch players in Dallas-Fort Worth. I can't take care of 300,000 people, yeah. But I can manage and take care of 50 people or 75 people, and they can take care of the 300,000 people, right? So it's happy employees, well-supported direction, you know, given good direction and leadership, and then they can take care of the fans, right? Same thing with, you know, with the Dallas Stars and the American Airlines Center, same thing that the, you know, Mavericks do, same thing that pro sports is all about, and it's about sports entertainment. And so from my standpoint, I didn't go join the Circuit of the Americas because I was so in love with F1. I just studied about it a little bit, and then it saw the potential, so we went, and it was – yeah, a huge success, almost religious experience for some people. And esports is the same thing, except it has no barriers. It is worldwide now. You know, it's like soccer, like F1 goes around the world in races, but it's not worldwide. It's not popular worldwide.
Right.
Right. MotoGP goes around the world in races, but it's not popular everywhere. Soccer is about the only thing that's popular almost everywhere. And esports scales more like soccer than any other sport, right? American football, as great as it is, is really only popular in America and now, you know, kind of burgeoning into Western Europe. And so when you look at this opportunity, like, you know, I'm a strategic analyst, you know, for, you know, my current job. And so I looked at this, like I would look at it, you know, for a potential client. And it was, it's not just that you're, that you want to be involved. It's like, you have to do it. You have to get in there, right? Like, I've got four kids, 18, 12, 12, and 10. They've never watched 1 second of taped or live traditional sports on television. Like, it is so not interesting to them that I just try to get my 10-year-old girl, who's a big soccer player, to watch, like, watch this movie in the World Cup. She will tolerate it for 7 seconds while I show her that movie, and then she is off back on the computer, the iPad, or phone, playing Minecraft or something else, or watching YouTube videos of, you know, the people she likes who do that, you know, because that's her participatory experience with media and entertainment that she has now. And that's the world, right? That's that generation in the world. And so when you look at esports, it's the tip of the spear of that. And it is, in 15 years, traditional sports will be more like esports than esports is like traditional sports, right? Like, that's that's going to happen. It's
the audience is going to flip. Yeah. At one point, the scales are going to tilt, and you're going to see the, I mean, what is now known as the kooky youth of America is going to become the majority.
Right. And it's going to, and but they're going to have interrelated influences on each other, right? There's some aspects of traditional sports that esports is going to adapt and grow into, like live events and gathering scale of fans together for an experience that's social and festive that they can't have by themselves, right? So, like, if you look at AT&T Stadium and you go for the Final Four when the Mavs have the NBA All-Star game here, or a big game, or the college football playoff games, it's as much about the outside of the building as it is the inside of the building, right? Like, it's just this festive, social, pageantry, Roman Coliseum thing going on, right? And so esports will start taking on, you know, and tournaments like that, and esports are already like that, right? Like, when you traveled around the world, you saw that in many countries, and that connection and sharing and kind of social festivity. And that's going to happen more and more often here, and not just for tournaments, but also home games. Now, maybe not on a scale immediately that's 100,000 people.
Baby steps.
But it'll happen. And then what will also happen is traditional sports will take on more elements of esports, which is more participatory, more larger scale, trying to break down the scale. Like, building a place for 100,000 people to physically gather is expensive. But the great thing about esports is, like, I was over at his office on Monday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and Siegel is practicing, streaming on Twitch. He's got 10,000 people watching him. You know, Monday at 1 p.m. Do you think the Dallas Stars would like to be able to charge $5 a month for people to watch them practice, you know, out in Frisco, and then interact with the players, and the players come off the ice and, you know, fire off a couple of, you know, salutations back to the fans, and, you know, and have that sort of, do you think the players would like that revenue stream? I mean, this guy, this player is making 10 grand a month during the offseason streaming practices, right?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah.
Do you think Jamie Benn would like to have that revenue stream, or do you think Dak Prescott would like to have that? I mean, like, that's something that will happen in the future, right?
With,
like,
traditional sports. With traditional sports. They're going to kind of level back down to more fan level.
And also, you'll see probably crossover in the meantime between, you know, like, our team and people like that, because they'll want to borrow each other's audiences.
Yeah, I can totally imagine Twitch chat for NFL games, right? Like, can you imagine that?
Man.
You know, can you imagine Twitch chat for some of the sporting events that you love to watch? I mean, but think about it. It makes total sense if fans can interact and, like, you know, comment on
those
some
poor
of the
Browns fans.
That, yeah,
they're going to get burned on Twitch. The Steelers fans are going to.
You know, especially in a sport like the NFL, though. I mean, you have so much built-in rivalries are already there. You can imagine how fun it would be just to be able to talk smack with the other team's fandom and have that back and forth.
It's going
to
happen. And when you watch an NFL game, there's going to be a right-hand column of all the, you know, comments coming in. And, like, you know, great play will happen. So people will start, like, pumping money to that player. Like, that's awesome. They'll start giving them, hey, here's five for that guy,
donation,
here's 10 for that
donation,
guy.
Donation.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely it's coming. Because gaming and esports scale is what? The world. Right?
Yeah.
Of those 10,000 people watching Seagull the other day, how many were from Asia? Right? Where it's like one of the interesting things, I've been working in Japan, Hong Kong, Jakarta the last 6 months. So you get a little screwed up in your time sometime. Like you wake up and you tell your wife good morning. She says good night because she's going to bed right then, and whatever. So the time's different. So when he's streaming, you know, here at 1 p.m., well, that's 7 p.m. in Europe, right? And it's like noon, you know, or midnight in Asia. I mean, like it's – so now the audience is never asleep. It's like, oh, well, we shouldn't be broadcasting on Twitch because the audience is asleep. The audience is never asleep, you know, never.
And one thing, too, if we're on the topic of just the reach of esports, right, I think one thing, if you think of baseball, right, the MLB, the big issue that everyone's talking about now is the age gap, right? The younger audience is not getting involved with MLB, where esports is kind of unique in the sense of the sky is the limit as far as the age isn't really an issue, right? You kids are going to play video games, and I think it's going to be that way for, I would almost say, forever. Like, I don't ever, maybe my kids will think it's lame to play video games because dads enjoy it, but I don't see that happening.
I'm 51, I still play video games, and they're a hell of a lot better than Defender and Pong and all the stuff. And
you're gonna
Space
make
Invaders
Pong an
I had.
Is Envious going to get a Pong team now that Jeff is here?
I got a couple guys. I could probably make it happen, I'll tell you that.
I wasn't good then, so I can't. There's nothing that's better at 51 than there was at 18. There's nothing.
It's kind of crazy the reversal, though, right? Like, I felt like 5 years ago, it was esports feeling like they needed to catch up to traditional sports, right? Yeah. What can we do to become more mainstream? And now you're seeing that role reversed where esports are kind of leading the way and finding new initiatives and finding ways to branch out to fans that we never thought we would be able to do. And it feels like regular sports are trailing behind and trying to find that new way to communicate.
Yeah. Well, so in the business I'm in right now, what you're trying to do to create great things is find their best version of their authentic self, right? So we're competing for this ballpark in Japan, the place where Yu Darvish played, a place called Hokkaido Fighters. Fighters. So baseball in Japan is not like baseball here necessarily. It's been adapted just like, you know, animation has there, like Halloween has there. You know, Halloween got started by Disney there in Japan, and now it's just taken on a life of its own into kind of this cosplay.
Like the whole holiday thing of Halloween was brought by
Disney?
Yeah,
just got invented. You know, I mean, they didn't have it until Disney shows up. Disney rolls it out, and then they're like, dress up in outfits.
Cosplay in Japan, here we go.
Eat candy. We are in.
Japan is like, we dress up anyway. Yeah, why not get candy for
it? Yeah, like it's crazy, right? But they adapt it and they change it to what they want to be, and then they go. Yeah. Like they, you know, they don't mess around. So baseball, same thing. And so when you're designing the park there, you have to really listen to them and kind of, because they're not real blunt or overt, you have to kind of listen for the, you know, the little hints. And then you have to design something that's perfect for them. So the ballpark we're designing, which hopefully that HKS will win, does not look like an American ballpark necessarily, does not look like one of their Japanese current ballparks, which are just kind of miscellaneous soccer domes. It looks like something that's authentic and unique for them, right? Well, that's what esports should do, right? It shouldn't just copy traditional sports, and it shouldn't be trapped in what it's done already. It needs to just find its authentic best self, and it's going to adapt over time, and it's going to be spectacular because it's not just about kids playing games, and it's not it's about people. Like earlier we talked about the scale, right? So the other thing is the barriers. What are the barriers to playing sports, right? Why is soccer so popular? Because all you need is a dirt field and a ball, you know? And so football, you need equipment. Ice hockey, you need ice rinks, which are incredibly expensive and difficult to maintain, especially in adverse climates. Baseball, you need a certain amount of people, a certain amount of space, et cetera. Golf, you need a lot of land. So there's a lot of barriers to these things, right? You know, gaming, essentially, there's almost no barriers. Now all the games are free, pretty much, you know, and if you don't get involved in the microtransactions, you don't have to, right? So there's almost no barriers, no gender, body shape, height, religious, political.
There's a startup with the, you know, if you're PC and you get the max
but a lot of people are starting to play on their phone, and almost, you know, not everyone has a phone, not everyone has connectivity, but I'm just saying the barriers to it are very low, right?
Yeah. A couple $100 and you're in.
Right. And how people allocate that money in a lot of societies is, if you give me something that gives me thousands of hours of enjoyment, I'll do that before I do a TV now, right? Like, how many people have a TV and no phone?
Yeah.
How many people have a phone and no TV? Many more have a phone and no TV, right? So it's just changed, right? And so the very, very low barriers. And so that makes the spread really quick, right? And so you see something like Fortnite, you know, I mean, you heard of Fortnite before most people, you know, did, but it's just gone nuts, right? Because the spread is really quick.
They're talking about making, what, $318 million just this past month alone in Fortnite as far as revenue goes. Those guys are showing some astronomical numbers, and it just kind of feels like a flavor of, I mean, not to say that Fortnite won't last. I think it has a bright future, but there's always something new coming out, right, that keeps it interesting, keeps the industry feeling fresh, where, you know, we bring up baseball again. There's a stale feel at the moment, right? And they're trying to find a way to attract a new audience. With games, you don't have to worry about that. Every year you can go to E3 and see the next lineup that you're going to be playing for the next 2-3 years and beyond.
You got PUBG competing with Fortnite. You got Fortnite competing with Realm Royale.
To play devil's advocate, though, for someone, Mike, where you are more invested into, you know, the scene of esports and gaming and which games are going to hit, does that worry you that there are a lot of games? You know, Fortnite is huge, but now you have Realm Royale, you have Call of Duty's coming out with a Battle Royale mode, Battlefield. So does that worry you about when you're trying to get into a game, like maybe there's too much of, you know, one thing?
I wouldn't say it's worrisome. It can be keep you on your toes, for sure. It keeps us on our toes. But, you know, you also got to pick and choose at some point, you know, what you want to support and what you don't. And, you know, I think right now within our organization, we're in a period where we're prepping to be prepared for the next wave of games. So, you know, we've kind of trimmed down a little bit and are just kind of prepping our internal organization in terms of building infrastructure, making good hires, starting to really focus on being able to work great with partners, having that internal staff that can execute for sponsors and advertisers and other partners that we bring into the business. So we've kind of trimmed down from, you know, being in 11 games down to about 6 or 7, 8 now. But, you know, from there, we kind of want to be able to launch out with the games that we think are like kind of the new wave. And I think those games are coming soon. I think Battle Royale is kind of the cusp of it right now. You know, with all these different developers and publishers making Battle Royale games. So we are making investment, obviously, in the Fortnite. We're staying close to Hi-Rez and Realm Royale. We think that game's great. So we're really kind of in this position of let's prepare for the next wave. And I think that's what happens. You know, like Anoush said, it happens at E3. You can kind of get an idea of what's coming soon. So, you know, it's always going to be a constant kind of up and down in the number of teams that we're supporting, and that's okay. I wouldn't say we're worried about it whatsoever. I mean, it's kind of the way it's been for years. We just take the necessary steps to scale when we can and support the games we can. If we can support all of them, great. Unfortunately, we don't have an endless budget, so we try to make sure that we're supporting the teams that the fans of our organization care about. And now, you know, more so, we're considering what the fans in Dallas and DFW or Texas think about.
We appreciate that.
Well, you know, we're super cheap. Like, if you need professional solitaire players, Minesweep, like, I think, like, a free T-shirt and
CSGO.
Well, if you can convince millions of people around the world to watch you play Minesweeper, then...
Then Jeff is really doing his job if he's figured that out.
Yeah, I don't think you want to put that much pressure on him right now. I don't need you to. Let's hold off on that.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, one thing you mentioned that I've always found interesting is esports on the mobile platform. How much of a push is Envious making, or, you know, the esports scene in general making to, like, try and welcome what seems like the outsider in gaming, right? You have your consoles, your Xboxes, PS4s, PC gaming, and then you have mobile. It feels like it's trying to make its way in, but yet I feel like the most profit can come from mobile just because the number of users is infinite at this point, right? Like, kind of like you mentioned there.
Yep.
So barrier entry to nothing. And then the games, again, are these mobile platforms that seem to work well. How much of a push is the esports scene making to welcome kind of the mobile gaming platform?
Yeah, I think it's one thing that everybody's trying to figure out, because, you know, we have somebody in the office, our vice president of business development and mobile gaming is Andrew Peterman, and he joined our team in December. And he's, you know, toying with the idea, and we're all wondering, can it be very successful in esport? I think one of the barriers that mobile gaming has in esports is that for a game to be big in esports around the world, it needs to have this kind of wow factor, and it needs to be able to, like any other sport that's watched in an arena or on television or, you know, distributed worldwide, you have to have this wow factor, this moment, the moments in the game where you jump out of your seat like, holy, you know, F, that was crazy, that what just happened, and the fans jump out of their seat screaming and clapping and going crazy and hugging each other because they just witnessed greatness. But with a mobile, you know, somebody tapping on a phone,
I just pictured it.
It's kind of hard to get that emotion, you know, for somebody just punching buttons on a tablet, punching the screen with their fingers, you know. I think that's the biggest barrier for mobile esports. But that's not to say people won't watch it on Twitch or watch it played, you know, on television. I think that is the best place for mobile esports is to gain their viewership online and digitally, like any of the other esports titles. But I think it's going to be very tough to pack 20,000 people into an arena to watch Clash Royale, you know. But that's not to say that can't happen. I hope it does, and we'd be right there to support it.
And to Jeff's point, mobile esports is one of the easier path to entries, right? Literally anyone can play. I mean, they make the games to be played on almost every smartphone available. You don't have to buy a fancy graphics card to play it. It's literally anyone could pick it up and play. Now, the mobile are typically the ones plagued with microtransactions, so they do have that downside. But I know, what was that one we just talked about last episode? There's some like first-person shooter on mobile that was just given like $6 million to invest in their esports side. And it's like, for a mobile game, mm-hmm. that just blows my mind.
Well, you know, I think one of the best things that mobile developers can do with their game is actually make it cross-platform, just like, you know, PC games like Fortnite, for example. Yeah, like PC games or console games are starting to go cross-platform. Yeah. Well, if, you know, you dev a game for mobile, great, but port it over to the PC and let PC players join in on the action too. So that way, you know, you can get, it's like a mobile, it's like an endemically mobile title for esports, but you're allowing players on console or PC to play, join in on the action as well. And can you balance your game to be fair for all?
And also, just from a macro industry standpoint, the more people who are playing games, you know, not everyone who goes to a Mavericks game played basketball, right? Not everyone goes to a Cowboys game played football, you know, or Rangers or Stars. Certainly not everyone goes to a Stars game played hockey. There's only a couple thousand of people play hockey locally. So
you got two guts right here.
You know, so yeah,
you guys do play hockey, don't
we do.
You?
Yeah. So God bless you.
It's a way to stay cool in the summer.
So to Mike's point, the experience has to be incredible. When we start the live local experience, it'll be incredible. But you don't just want just the players who play that game to come. You want them to invite someone to come with them that's special to them, whether it's having their parents bring them, friends to kind of show them what's going on. And that's how people share things, right? Like, that's how we built a crowd in Dallas for hockey, is that people who knew hockey brought people who were kind of intrigued by it, brought their friends, coworkers, you know, wives, et cetera, kids. And then they shared it with them. And then those people are exposed to it and see the greatness of it. And then they get hooked to it, right? And so that's how esports will be too.
Yeah, this is happening. Right? Yeah, like we, you know, our watch parties, for example, you know, we've had, or fan day, we've had, you know, 1,000 people show up to that. And you see, I've met a lot of fans here in Dallas already. And I shake hands with them, talk to them all the time. You know, I've met so many of them who are like, we had no idea what esports were, but my buddy brought me here and it's freaking awesome, right?
You got my wife to go to one, which is really, that's the Moby Dick of getting people into esports into life. So mission accomplished on that one.
Well, yeah, thanks. Well, this is just the beginning for us, right? I mean, we have some really, really aggressive plans to give the fans in Dallas and North Texas, you know, an amazing esports experience in the long run. And we want to, it's our job. That's my job, right? And it's Jeff's job. We need to create the best possible entertainment experience for the fans here. And that's what we're going to do. And it's not just going to be for the people who play the games that we're competing with. It's going to be for them and their families and their friends and the people that they want to spend time with on the weekend watching a match, or spend time with coming out to meet our players and meet our organization. And that's our job. So we're here to do that. We're going to make sure that you're able to bring in any age group, any demographic, just anybody here in the area that you're buddies with, to have a good time with us watching esports.
Yeah, and with Dallas Fuel, it was easy because, you know, they have Dallas in the name, so it was easy for people to kind of attach to the team. But you said that you wanted to expand your outreach. What are your plans to do that with, let's say, you know, someone like me, Tim, Anuj, to get somebody interested in Team Envious who doesn't, you know, they're not attached to a city?
Yeah, we have some plans for that. I mean, there a lot of the teams that we harbor under the Envy organization actually have a lot of online competition. So I hope not too early talking about this, but one of the things we're kind of toying with, I think we're beyond toying with it. I think we're actually in the execution phase of this. We want to create a small live venue for some of those teams to actually play in front of a live audience instead of just playing out of our office.
So like playing an online match, but
yeah,
with a live audience.
Exactly. Yeah. And so we would be the first team to ever do that. And I think we might be the first team to actually execute it.
I hear you have a guy that knows a thing or two about stadiums.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, found a guy somewhere around here. Yeah.
If any of the signage is in Japanese, forgive me. You know, it's just been, I've had a lot of that on my mind lately.
The Ham Fighters, Envious, yeah. Dallas Fuel.
And is that planning to be in Dallas proper?
You know, it's not something I can really say.
I mean, you can fire them if they get mad. No, I'm just saying whatever you want.
It's not something I can really tell you a yes or no on.
Oh, okay.
We're still working through all this.
Okay.
You know, we're having some really great discussions still with all the different pockets of DFW and all the different cities around the area. The city of Dallas has been great. Still having great conversations with them. Still trying to figure out where we'll land long term. We have really aggressive plans for a much larger, kind of kick-ass, world-class arena in the long run. But we're trying to get something done now.
Right.
We feel like we need to give the fans something now.
I think the last time we spoke to you was after stage one of Overwatch League. And I assume I haven't heard, I mean, Overwatch League doesn't email me personally on what they're making owners do. But the last I heard is that by end of season two, they want teams to start having home games?
That's right. So 2020, we'll be here, yeah, in Dallas with having home matches here.
Okay, and I guess that's all kind of built into the plan.
Yeah, so if we were to, for example, construct a brand new arena, it's going to take years.
Right.
It's going to take a few years, right? It won't be ready by 2020 if we do a ground-up construction.
Right, do it right the way you want to do it.
Right. So we have kind of three options right now. One is, basically play in something that's already pre-built, you know, in the interim, or maybe we decide to stay there long term. And let's say like the Toyota Music Factory or the AAC or, you know, any of the large event centers around DFW. Option two is to temporarily play in one of those event centers while we build out a larger arena, create our own temporary space that we hold esports events in, which is the likely scenario right now, where we build out a smaller venue where the fans can go ahead and start watching us and engaging with us locally while we build out the much bigger arena over a couple years. And then there's option three, which is just build it as fast as possible and don't do anything until it's complete. But I would say option two is kind of where we are right now,
mm-hmm.
is build out a temporary space that'll last a couple years that we can go ahead and start immediately bringing fans in to watch our teams play.
And that would really be kind of especially in Dallas and DFW, like that is untapped potential right there, is having your dedicated esports. Columbus, they have the MLG arena. You have the Blizzard arena in LA. Vegas has their arena.
Yep.
But there's nothing here that was purposely designed for the sole aspect of that esports fan experience. Well,
and you're starting to see that now, though, right? So we met with Jason Lake not too long ago. And
yep.
It looks like they have something in the works also at the Frisco Star. They're taking over a whole floor over there where they'll have a live, you know, venue where people can come and watch games, like you said, if they're online or...
just talking to the mic.
If they're online or if they're, going to be playing at a LAN or something, they'll be able to attend it over there. And I guess there were some rumors that were mentioned of Optic even looking at something, you know, to be housed in Dallas.
Yeah, they're doing the Arlington project. And,
yeah.
And, you know, just to be transparent about that, we're still talking to them and maybe we'll land there to play some games there in Arlington temporarily.
Yeah.
But again, there's no home teams, Dallas-based teams,
yeah,
that actually can bring teams,
yeah,
from outside to play against them in Dallas, except for us, right? So those teams are, I mean, for us, we're able to actually have a schedule where we're going to play, you know, 20 home matches, anywhere between 16 and 20 home matches here in Dallas, and that's a thing. And we're going to have production behind it, and you know, the full power of the Overwatch League. Yeah. Yeah, starting in 2020. There's no other team here that can do that, right? If they're going to do it, they're going to have to just basically schedule exhibition matches with other teams and invite them to come play against
nothing
them in a live audience.
It's
nothing official, yeah. Right? And so what they're trying to do is attract, I guess, some larger tournaments here, but that's not a team that you're rooting for locally. So we have that kind of advantage right now of being able to give the fans that. And like I said, it's our job to give the fans here in Dallas an entertaining venue and an entertaining experience. And I think we're the best team for that and the best organization for that here in Dallas. And I think we're going to show that pretty soon.
Is that something you're hoping Jeff gets involved with right away? Is because I know you said you're kind of already
we hired him for a reason, right? I mean, the guys, you look at his resume, well, he's a pretty incredible experienced candidate that we saw and we said, wow, that's like it hits all the check marks, right? I mean, he's got sales and marketing experience on a professional sports level for made it through two ownership changes and with the Dallas Stars, right? You know, he's got venue experience.
He was there when there was no ownership.
Yeah, that's right.
That's true. The most painful of all.
Right?
So Jeff checks so many boxes for us. That's really going to help us figure out how we can achieve that goal and objective of giving the fans here in Dallas the best experience possible.
So, Jeff, what is the, you know, coming in, you've been on the job for 24 hours now, so you should have plenty of answers here. But what are some of the biggest challenges you see early on, you know, entering this environment?
I would say it reminds me a lot of F1 in a way, that you can drown in opportunity. I mean, there are literally 1,000 things you could do right now in this space. So, in the first day of economics class in college, they talk about how do you allocate scarce resources, time, money, attention, things like that, right? And that's the biggest thing. It's just being strategic in how you allocate those things, because they have money, they have, you know, time, they have good employees, but there are 1,000 things. So it's a very distracting environment because there's so many potential things to do. So you have to strategically plot the direction of your journey. You don't know the end of it yet because you don't know what the space is going to do, the market's going to do. So you just have to be directionally correct. And that's why Mike is so important, is because he's been doing this for, you know, it sounds ridiculous in esports. He's a huge veteran. He's been doing it for 15 years, right? So that's like, he's like the Red Auerbach of esports, you know? He's got a cigar and a cane and he's like, you whippersnappers. And he's only 35. So, yeah. You know, he's, but you just have to be directionally right. And then you have to just be strategically right about how you allocate your resources. And you don't, and so in F1, they'd always say, you can't boil the ocean. You don't have enough resources to do everything and take on these huge tasks and do everything. So when you're going to be reading every single day about all these things in esports, and there's going to be articles about this and this and this. And so everyone turns, oh, well, we should do that. And we could do that. And they're right. You can do that. And we should do that. But you can't do everything.
Yeah.
You have to pick things and be great at it. Right. And then you can add the other things on in time. Doesn't mean just because you don't do it next 6 months, you're not going to do it. But you have to do things and support them and stick with them and carry them through. And then you can add to it. So it's like a building a pyramid. Right?
Probably better to be really good at something than half-ass 10 different things.
Right. You don't want to be fickle about things.
Yeah.
We did it. We did it for 6 weeks. It didn't work. You want to pick the right things, invest in them, support them, and grow them. Right? Because your brand, you know, like we're talking about the fuel or Envy, building your brand is essentially that consistent thing that people can trust over time. Like they know from Mike's standpoint that his teams, you know, have been – winners and competing at the highest level, you know, every time they go out there, right? So they don't always win, but they're always going to give it a great shot, right? So you can trust that. And you can feel like, hey, if I attach to that, then I'm not going to be disappointed with the level of effort. It's kind of like the Cowboys. They haven't won very much, but you know Jerry wants to.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know he's crazy about it. So people kind of attach to the Cowboys and don't think that they're going to have an owner go dormant on them for 10 years and cut the budget and go low. Same thing with Cuban. Mavericks don't always win, but you know Cuban wants to win.
He's going to do everything
right?
he can.
And he's going to do everything yeah. he can, including occasionally break a rule here or there. Right? But that's, you want that, right? You like your... You
or
like
go back to, crying, you know? DeAndre Jordan like it seems like they're doing right now.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Well, but, you know, it's you know, sometimes you got to forgive and forget. And if that's the best thing for them to do right now, then they have to do it. And so I think that's what we have to focus on. It's just, you know, the brand promise is what someone knows they can trust from your company over time. And that's where I think we have to be, you know, they've been stable, they've been growing, they've been winning. And that's a great base. So now it's just about where do we go from here?
And I'd be doing the fans a disservice having Mike on the show and not bringing up the teams and the brand. So that's a perfect segue into the Dallas Fuel. We had you on after stage one. Not the best, but there was room for improvement. Stage two and three happened. You saw improvement, but the hole was dug at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But then stage four happened, and it was almost like all the fans forgot about the first three stages, and they don't even care that they're not in the playoffs because stage four was like, this is what we knew. This is what we were waiting for.
I told you guys we'd bring it back. I told you we'd do it. I wasn't lying. I won't lie to you ever.
What was it like from, you know, inside the locker room from the team to see them, that roller coaster of a season?
The first three stages sucked. You know, it was just rough. I mean, we dealt with so many internal issues in terms of, I think we as an organization made a couple mistakes, but certainly nothing, you know, egregious or, you know, there was no serial mismanagement of the team or anything like that.
Well, so much of it, I felt, was out of your hands as well as an organization.
We had a lot of players that, you know, this is the first season of a professional sports league with players who have never been professional athletes before or have never been professional gamers before. And they, I think, had a lot of pressure on them and a lot of stress on the players, and it really caused a lot of flying off the wheel. Okay, you know, I mean, it's and you can't blame the players for that. It's something that they were thrown into, and that I think a lot of the players didn't expect the environment to be so stressful and so competitive right off the bat, and it was, and it threw our team for a little bit of a loop. But I'll tell you, it was almost like you couldn't script it better. The only way you could script it better is if we went on to make the actual season playoffs and win the whole thing. Yeah. But we damn near won the, you know, stage four playoffs, right? Yeah. We were super close to being this juggernaut that was New York. And you know, it was like we won the Overwatch League is what it felt like. But it was such a redemption story, right, because of just how bottomed out we had been. And to bring it back and finish like that, I'll tell you guys, we have such a good handle on it now, and the players have such a good handle on it now. I mean, I think we're way ahead of the other Overwatch League teams now just because we experienced so many holes, and we filled those holes, and we filled a lot of gaps, and we're complete now. I mean, I'm telling you, we're going into Season 2 really with a complete team, and we're really happy about that. And I think the fans are extremely happy about that. It was a really great redemption story. And so thanks to all the fans out there who support us from day one and all the way through the end when we were on fire.
How are the rosters working for season two? I've never really grasped it, you know, figured it out. So do you get to keep your roster now, or are you re-signing? How does that work?
Yeah, so every player that's contracted to our team currently, we have an option on their contract.
Okay.
Okay, so we can decide as an organization if we want to option the contract for season two. And so we can guarantee to keep the same team if we would like to. We also can release players in the offseason, whereas, you know, we can create some room on our salary cap and create some room on the roster to sign new players by releasing players. But, you know, there are going to be players on our team that we don't want to let go, and we'll absolutely option their contract. I think September 2nd is the date the option period closed. So by September 2nd, we have to declare all the players on our roster that we would like to option for season two. Now, after season two, it's a free-for-all, as it's written.
You can sign
the rules.
Yeah. Long contracts.
Every player is free agent at the end of season two. And so, you know, that's the way it's kind of working out right now. And we're working with the league to see what's best long-term in the league, but that's kind of the way it's going to work for now.
So you couldn't even sign any of them to a long-term contract right now, that you have to wait until season two.
That's right.
Is the big part of that the 2020 move of home-at-home games and having that flexibility? Or
You know, I don't think that was planned.
Okay.
I don't think it was planned to be in, you know, to have basically every player become free agents right before we do home games. I think, you know, I pretty sure I can be transparent about this. We were actually trying to get home games in 2019. We were trying to make it happen, but, you know, obviously
every team kind of has to
12 teams in the league already, you know, having to build an arena or have a, you know, a home venue ready to go for
expansion teams that might happen.
Yeah. Oh, that's happening.
Yeah.
That's happening.
Yeah.
Right. So
you got just blink if any team is foreign.
We'll just say names.
Just blink twice.
I blink twice for people that are listening. Yeah,
blinking.
Well, I don't know that for sure. let me just clear that up. I actually don't know what teams have been sold to for the Overwatch League to expand into. I have no idea.
Oh, so they even keep that pretty hush?
Yeah,
for owners. Hush.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we don't know as of right now. We'll probably know before, you know, it's released to the public at some point here, and I think you're going to hear about it soon. But I imagine, you know, based on our conversations at the owners meeting and so on, that we're going to have some pretty cool foreign markets. So again, it's a global sports league, the first of its kind.
If the signing period is September 2nd, you would think they would want to probably get those teams in play to give them a shot at also grabbing up some of the talent.
Yeah, there's some really favorable rules though for the expansion teams where they can kind of cherry pick out of the contenders series to grab players. And there's a lot of good talent that they can buy from other teams too. I mean, they can come in and, you know, and find some players that are either on the bench or starters that they want to come in and make a big play for. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if some of the big new expansion teams come in and want to try and make a deal for some of our great players. So it's going to be interesting, that's for sure. We're such a family, though. It's going to be tough to part with any of those guys.
I would like to take just a moment to talk about Siegel a little bit, because I felt like he's been one of the most enjoyable players to watch throughout the season. Because, I mean, A, he's Siegel. He comes in as a celebrity already, right? But then he kind of struggled at the start. And you even saw it, like, with his body language a little bit. He kind of went MIA there for a little bit of the season. No one really knew what was going on. And then he came back, and I would say, starting with Stage 3, but especially in Stage 4, his body language, I mean, it was like a light switch that just switched. That's what a light switch to Jeff's got me.
Yeah.
He knows what I'm talking about.
Yep.
I'm tracking with you.
So was there anything inside the room that changed with Siegel was it just playing better that made it the difference?
Yeah. I mean, myself and our vice president of team operations, Graham Henry, busted our ass, man, to make sure that we improved the clubhouse environment. And a fellow sports team owner told me recently, never underestimate the clubhouse environment. And we really worked hard, man. It was night and day, all day long, all night long, making sure that we were taking the necessary steps to improve what the club felt like. And I think, you know, we had to let go of our former coach, Kyle. And I think, you know, that change just kind of uplifted the team a little bit. It wasn't necessarily Kyle's fault or anything, but just being able to get a fresh...
Turn the page,
get a fresh start. We brought in a lot of great people to help the team, including... Don Kalkstein, who's the director of sports psychology for the Mavericks and the Texas Rangers. Don, he goes by DK. Everybody calls him DK. Amazing guy here in Dallas. If you don't know who he is, you're missing out. I mean, he helped the professional athletes here for going on 20 years now with the Rangers and the Mavericks. You know, he's taking the Rangers to the World Series, won an NBA championship with the Mavericks. I mean, he's...
good looking resume.
Yeah, he's a big help, and he's really helped our clubhouse get better, and we're going to continue to work with him to create, you know, the identity of who the Dallas Fuel Club is. And not just him, but our personal trainer Paul, who's working with the players, you know, the guys that are providing food to the players, you know, the management team, the new coaches, assistant coaches, all those things just kind of came together in harmony to create, you know, the position that we ended up in. And I think that was super rewarding, right? And to be specific to your question, I think Brandon Siegel benefited a lot from that, and almost had a breath of new life, you know, breathed into him. So
I mean, it wasn't even just me. Like, you know, I'm on the Discord, I'm on the subreddit for Dallas Fuel. All the fans even pointed out it just looked like the team was having more fun. Like, win or lose, they just looked like they were having fun.
Yeah, it wasn't just they were just having more fun. They were having, like, an incredible time. And I think that is so important. I think having fun in sports, not just esports, in sports. You know, I've competed in sports my whole life. If you're having fun with your teammates on the field when you're competing, if you're smiling and laughing and when you're beating the shit out of Oh, sorry, I'll
take we're not live. Out, it's okay.
We
fine.
Can say that.
Oh, yeah, you can
okay,
say that.
Great. Yeah, when you're beating live. The shit out of another live. Team, okay, you can have a good time, right? And it snowballs into performance, right? Like if you're connecting with your teammates on that level and everybody's, you know, having a great time, you perform better. It's just a fact. And I think, you know, that happened to our team. It was just like electricity. Everybody was performing better.
That's right. So,
you know, one thing that I know we're getting close to your cutoff time here, but I would hate to not bring it up as a CSGO fan. First and foremost, that's what got me into esports. You know, we talk about clubhouse environments, and you're starting to see that there was obviously clubhouse issues going on with Team Envy as a CSGO team, which, you know, now due to performance and all that has led to obviously their release, which you announced just last week.
Mm-hmm.
What are the future plans for, you know, CSGO and Team Envy?
CSGO is tough, man. I mean, look, there's no like governing body in CSGO. I'll tell you guys a little secret on the business side here. It's so diluted. The scene is just so diluted. Our team plays all the time against the other teams all the time. There's this.
I don't think that's much of a secret, Mike.
Yeah, yeah.
I think right. Everyone knows
well,
that.
Well, yeah. It's like it's
we've seen the schedule. We try to keep up with it.
We are one of the top CSGO organizations of all time, right? And had one of the top ranked teams and won world championships and, you know, tons of international titles. I think we have like 14 international titles or 15 international titles. But the sheer amount of accessibility that you have to watch Counter-Strike matches, the pro team's playing every day, right? And so I think the whole scene has just gotten watered down. And there are so many different tournaments and tournament providers and so many different leagues that it's almost impossible to monetize Counter-Strike. The player salaries balloon so fast. Expectations of what you have to provide players, you know, the contracts were just insane. It was impossible for us as a business to make money off of it. And in addition, we were supporting a team that's in Europe. So we had a European division and we're running the team here from Dallas over in Europe. And it just wasn't a great business opportunity for us anymore. It wasn't a great synergy between us and the organization over there when we have so much going on here in Dallas now. And I think there was not a lot of synergy amongst the players on the roster anymore. And so all of that kind of led to us saying, okay, let's do what we're supposed to do here. Let's release a team. Let's focus on trying to get back into Counter-Strike in a way that makes sense for us as an organization, as a business, and makes sense for the players that we're going to bring into the team. So we're looking toward, you know, trying to get a team here in North America. It doesn't mean we have to sign only North American players. It just means that we want the players to move here to Dallas and work closer with us here. And so we're working on that.
Are you looking at a full team buyout, individual players, whatever works?
I think that's wide open. Right now we're having some discussions with some really great players that are free agents here in North America. And we're also talking to organizations for potentially buying out, you know, full rosters that we can bring here to Dallas.
Brett's a silver too.
Okay.
So
you got a little way to go
if
there.
You need a fifth. You need a fifth.
Yeah.
After dealing with the Overwatch League, you know, season one is done. We have playoffs and all that, but you've lived through an entire season of Overwatch League. Does it make you look at other way esports are ran, like Counter-Strike or CWL, which is now toying with franchising, which I understand that they'll give you kind of the right to first talk about that because you were an owner of Overwatch League, so they're kind of giving you the tip of the hat there. Does it make you look at other esports and just think, what are you guys doing here?
Well, I'll start off by saying this. You know, game publishers and game developers are all different. And, you know, some of them have to focus on their core competency and their core business, which is developing video games and bring those to the masses to drive revenue and make money and be a business, right? So some of them are able to allocate enough resources to create an esports tour or series or league or esports support that makes sense for their game and they can fund it and have the resources and time to do it. But like Jeff said earlier, you got to kind of pick, you know, the different things that you want to do with your video game. So with that said, some developers and publishers are doing a great job of supporting esports. Some have great games for esports, but just don't have the resources to support a full-fledged, you know, esports ecosystem. Activision Blizzard is kind of this, I would call them kind of a unicorn in the sense that Bobby Kotick, you know, who runs the whole company,
mm-hmm.
CEO and chairman of Activision Blizzard, put together a business team behind the league, right? And created this true professional sports league. And I can tell you that it's unlike anything you've ever seen in esports, anything you're going to see for probably a while. I can go to meetings with a lot of game publishers that are running these kind of top tier esports titles, and you get maybe four or five guys that show up in hoodies and jeans. You know, I can tell you that when you show up for a meeting with Activision Blizzard as an owner of an Overwatch League franchise, you get 50 credited people, experienced people from professional sports in suits, and they're there to do business with you. And that is just a whole nother bar that's been raised. It's unlike anything else in esports that we have. And a lot of people don't get access to that. So I'm here to tell you that when we go to our owners meeting, it's an affair. It is a big event with a lot of experienced, smart business people in the room. And we're there to do one thing, and that's to make the best AM esports league in the world. And I wish that other publishers had the time and resources and could make the effort to replicate what we have with the Overwatch League with other games outside of Overwatch. And I hope that one day we'll get there. I think that we will. It's going to take some time. But really, everybody should give a hats off to Bobby Kotick at Activision Blizzard and his team of people that are working on the Overwatch League, because it's raised the bar for esports tremendously.
So are you excited for the possibility of CWL going franchise? Because Call of Duty was your baby. I mean, that's started.
I think we're happy to jump in that boat and bring the team to Dallas. I mean, I think, you know, at this point we would love to do that, because we are the actual in world championships, the most successful team of all time. Right. So it would be great to do that, but I think it's okay if we wait a little bit, because we're still kind of gathering our internal organization to be able to support multiple major franchises like that.
If only Valve was making money, they could do the same thing.
Yeah. Well, that's the deal, right? Like, Valve is making so much money that they don't need to really create, you know, a major esports league. You can make the same case for Activision Blizzard, but it's awesome that they did it, right? Yeah. Activision Blizzard did it because they care about it. They really care about it. They really wanted to do it. And you know, some wants are the same with game publishers, and some are different. I think Valve doesn't necessarily care or want to create that property for their company.
The template's being created, right?
Right.
And that's why it's so important that Activision Blizzard is doing that, is that they're plowing this field, right? So everyone else can look at it, and they don't necessarily have to go hire, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of guys to come in and tell them how to do it, because now their template is showing other people how to do it, right? And so that makes the next person who wants to do it, there's been already a lot of investment and a lot of trial that's gone on, and so it'll be easier for people to adapt going forward. And so I think, you know, the people who know what's going on will always know Activision Blizzard started that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you have Overwatch League, and then pretty much right after, you had League of Legends starting to franchise teams. Now CWL is going to start to do it. I do think you're going to see that generally go in that direction. But you talk about developers and how they operate their games can be different. You have the same developer who can operate two games completely different, like Valve. I mean, look at how they treat Counter-Strike and how they treat Dota. It's night and day, where Dota has all this special treatment. They got the international. When it's going on, you'll see Steam is just littered with international advertisement. And then you get majors, and you'll get a sticker here and there.
Yeah, I actually think it's super intelligent, though, from a business perspective, if you see what Valve cares about, right? Because at the end of the day, Valve has a competitor in the market, major competitor for Dota, right, with Riot and League of Legends and other MOBA games.
True.
Counter-Strike really didn't have, at the time, for the past few years, like this very great, you know, first-person shooter game on the PC. It just doesn't exist.
Still
right?
Hard. It's still not.
It's still
there,
hard, yeah. Right? It's still not there, right? You know, Overwatch has kind of come in and you know, done some work on it, but you know, Counter-Strike didn't have it until Overwatch, and so they didn't really need to pump a bunch of resources into it. The players that wanted to play a super quality, fun, very well-made competitive first-person shooter on the PC, there was pretty much one option. That's Counter-Strike, and it, you know, had a lot of cool stuff built around it, and so a lot of people joined in on that action. I think it's going to be tougher for them in the long run to maintain that level of interest in that we've had in Counter-Strike. You can already see the viewership waning a lot for Counter-Strike matches, professional Counter-Strike matches. There are lots of variables there, but I would love nothing more than to see Counter-Strike continue its success. I mean, it's been around for 17 years, and people are still watching and playing it, so been great.
I think overall, just for the industry, it's a plus because it's forcing organization owners such as yourself to bring in the business minds, right? So you're going to start to see these organizations ultimately run more professionally, I think handled more maturely in that sense. You're seeing that even like, you know, with complexity in these guys as well. But they're bringing in the business minds on the back end now.
Yeah, I mean, we spent the amount of money we spent getting that over Overwatch League franchise here. It's a kick in the ass. Like, okay, now you got to be a big boy, right? You got to really run your business
like a business.
You got to run your business like a business, man, because now there's a lot more financial risk. And yeah, I have partners and I have employees that rely on me to give them a paycheck every week. And so we got to make sure we're really careful about what we do. And it really has been fun and challenging, and there's a lot of pressure there too. And I've kind of all soaked it all in like a sponge, and I'm really enjoying it. And not only that, but I'm really enjoying the fact that we're here in Dallas. I can't imagine where we would be any happier right now. It's been great.
Esports is growing up. I remember back in the day when I was 15 playing Rainbow Six, all we wanted was a girl on the team because it was like an Insta sponsorship.
Yeah.
And now look at it. Well, guys, I wanted to thank you again for coming on. Jeff, it was an honor being able to welcome you into the esports world. I have all the confidence in the world. No pressure. Mike, thank you again for joining us on the show, talking esports, entertaining us. Any final thoughts on whether it be Team Envious in CSGO or Dallas Fuel, kind of where you're looking at for... I mean, we already talked a little bit about Season 2, but... As far as, let me ask you this. I know I'm closing the show down, but I just got a question, so I'm going to steal like 5 more minutes of your time. With Overwatch, when you're looking at Season 2 and roster and everything there, who knows what the game's going to be like by the time September rolls around? They could rework Reinhardt and 2 other heroes by then, which is a big reason on Stage 4 that you guys had a huge success because they kind of toned down on that dive meta as much as they did. Are you looking at certain players and styles getting ready for that? Or are you looking at this point, locker room personalities and all that?
I think the only thing that we know right now that we want to do is fill gaps. So we know we had some weak areas in terms of team compositions, the ability to play different play styles. We were typically the team that could play any play style before Dive kind of came the only thing that's out there. So, we know that we have some weaknesses on the team in terms of being able to adapt to play different multiple play styles. And they're just minor weaknesses, right? Just little gaps that we have. So we're just looking to fill those gaps. So when we come out in Season 2, the team that you saw on Stage 4 is the team you saw on Stage 4, but able to maybe punch through and win a couple more games than we won in Stage 4, which would put us at the top of the standings. And, you know, that's the goal right now, is just to fill those small gaps and bring in maybe a player or two that can do that for us and see what we can do.
Excellent. Excellent. Gentlemen, anything?
Man, just appreciate the time. Honestly, do. It's great. We love having a local team here to root for. It's something that as traditional sports fans, I think we were craving in this market. And so we're so happy and blessed that it's Team Envious. We know you guys are going to do a great job, and appreciate the time from both of you guys again.
Yeah, and I can't wait to bring my son out and watch one of the practices going on.
We got some pretty amazing news today that we'll announce over the next couple of days.
Just do it here. Go ahead.
No, can't do it yet. But there's going to be even more good Overwatch under our organization, and we're going to do some really amazing things for the fans here in Dallas too. So I'm really looking forward to Season 2 because I think the fans here can get together a lot more than we did this season locally here in Dallas.
Awesome. Well, Mike, thank you again. That was Mike Rufail, owner of Dallas Fuel and Team Envious. We have Jeff Moore, the new president and COO. Jeff, thank you again for taking the time. Gentlemen, until next time. And to you, the listener, we will see you next time. Because that just about does it for this edition of The Center Ring, a.k.a. TCR, a.k.a. your favorite esports podcast. If you're a new listener to the show, I thank you for listening. Even if you listened all the way through, this was an extra long episode, so you're crazy and I love you for it. If you skipped around, guess what? I love you all the same, because that's how we do it at The Center Ring. Again, be sure and follow us on all social media, at The Center Ring on Twitter, tcr.gg, there you go, I can talk, is the website that has all of our information. down from our Discord to our Twitch page, YouTube, where you can find all the previous episodes and interviews that we have done. You can even find the first episode, or the first interview, rather, that we did with Mike. And go listen to that. Next week, it will be a day early because Wednesday falls on the 4th of July, so we are not going to record that. Our wives would kill us, and we honor them. We will have Nathan Ragsdale on. He is the coach of Midland University's esports team. So we'll talk some college esports in the next episode of The Center Ring. But for Anuj, for Brett, this is Tim. We'll see you next time.